from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallraff Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of 100 Acres, the Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park, with its director, Lisa Fryman.
And I'll get to chat with jazz pianist Gary Walters about his new solo CD. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
Hundred Acres, the Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park, is opening this weekend with all kinds of art, music, nature, and architectural programming. Lisa Fryman, director of the park, came in to tell Sharon Gamble about the genesis of this IMA edition and why it blew museum directors from around the country away when the IMA hosted a recent conference.
Well, I want to start with, where did the idea of the Fairbanks Art and Nature Park come from?
It started, I believe, around 1996 when our former director, Brett Waller, was working with the IMA staff to develop a strategic plan for the institution. And in that strategic plan, they identified the park grounds as something that they wanted to develop for public use. A lot of people know of it in a private way. They'll go for hikes and picnics and other things. But, at that point, I think museum administrators recognize the fact that it had a lot to offer the public. And I think it lay fallow for a pretty long time in between a succession of directors. And then when I came 8 years ago, there were plans for it to be developed, and they had already done some preliminary community canvassing and forums and meetings with different constituents in order to understand how people might like to use the space, and they had a preliminary master plan, and that was back in 2001. I got here in August of 2002, 8 years ago, which is hard to believe.
I know. I still remember you coming to town and all the articles saying welcome to you. It feels like it was 3 weeks ago, not 8 years.
It is hard to believe it's been this long. I've had two kids in the interim and done a lot at the IMA, and it feels like I've been here a lot longer and also like a heartbeat at the same time.
So. I'm sure.
But that's what life is like.
Yeah, true.
But you know, I came, and one of the reasons I came here was for the opportunity to develop the park itself. It was clear that it was really an unprecedented opportunity in the United States to be able to develop an art and nature park from scratch. And I have to say, when I started, I was overwhelmed, you know, just the thought of running a contemporary program and developing the vision for an art and nature park. I was pretty much fresh out of my PhD program and several years of teaching in academia. And
congratulations, you have two more than full-time jobs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what happens when you get your PhD now, or actually when you do anything. You have more jobs than you ever anticipated, if you're lucky. Everyone's multitasking in the recession. But, I got here and I took a look at that master plan that had been very thoughtfully developed, but the primary impulse behind it was a pretty traditional one at that time. And
it
conceived of a sculpture park in 20th century terms. It thought of a sculpture park as an open air place for sculpture to be plopped down in perpetuity. And it seemed to me at that early point that given a clean slate, which essentially we were being given at the IMA, we needed to think about whether that model was still relevant for the 21st century. And we brought together a group of experts nationally in landscape architecture and art and history, and we met with them on for a couple of years. And essentially that question of what's going to make it a 21st century sculpture park was the most important question that I heard from that group, and it actually came from another museum director named Ned Rifkin. That question prompted me in a very uncomfortable way to rethink what we were doing. And it wasn't that I didn't already feel like it needed to be rethought, but I wasn't quite sure what direction to take it in. And
before you move on, I'm curious, was it hard to get those three groups of people to share vocabulary and share goals? Because it seems to me if I put a landscape architect and a more traditional architect together, they might or might not squabble about what to do with any given plot of land.
I don't think there were a lot of agendas. These people were really at the top of their game nationally and internationally in terms of thinking about the relationships between art and architecture and landscape architecture. So I think they were pretty comfortable sharing a common vocabulary and understanding what it was that we were setting out to do at the IMA. And so it was always, it felt to me like an extremely professional framework in which to ask difficult questions and have honest exchanges mm-hmm. for best practices.
About the discomfort. What made everybody feel a little new, this is different.
I don't think anyone felt that. To clarify, what I was saying is that my own discomfort came from that realization when I heard the question, "What makes a 21st century sculpture park?" And I thought, oh, my gosh, nobody has done this yet. I don't know the answer, and I don't think anybody knows the answer. And then I thought, I have a lot of work to do. And it was that critical question that really pushed me in a scientific way to analyze different sculpture parks around the United States and in Europe and to understand what the institutions were doing with them, how they were approaching art, whether it was modern or contemporary, whether it was with living artists or deceased artists, whether it was commissioned work, whether it was site-responsive work, whether it had nothing to do with the place, whether it was there permanently or whether it was there on a temporary basis. And one of the things that I realized was that at the IMA, we could take another 20th century approach, meaning we could, you know, buy a bunch of pre-existing sculpture that we placed in the park and left
and it
there.
It stays there forever.
But yeah. The problem with that is the problem of a permanent collection, frankly, yeah. And it can be a good thing and a bad thing, but it has a kind of static quality to it. And early on, I read a study that spoke about the fact that the number one reason people make return visits to museums is for changing exhibitions. And that idea, coupled with the question of what is a 21st century park, really set me on my way. And what I mean by that is I realized that if we wanted to be more than just a community asset, which I knew we were going to be no matter what we did because it was going to provide a place for the Indianapolis community and the regional community to come that was unique, how would we get people to come back here? How would we get people to make Indianapolis a destination on a national and even an international level? And since Indianapolis is not a huge tourist destination, that's a tricky question. And the idea of changing things out and making the park be sort of acknowledge its state of constant transformation seemed to be a way to really set the park apart from other initiatives throughout the United States. And then As I benchmarked with other institutions, I realized that there really was no sculpture park in the United States that focused all on commissioned site-responsive work.
Really?
Yeah. There's,
that's surprising there, to me.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to do commissioned projects with living artists.
Sure.
And, you know, you were asking a great question before about sort of the interdisciplinary nature of landscape architecture and architecture and art and how that worked out. But it goes even beyond that in a project like this, because you also have engineers and structural engineers and electricians and concrete masons and steel workers. And, I mean, it's been the most interdisciplinary thing I've ever worked on because of the nature of commissioning everything from scratch and then having to problem solve and figure out how to actually build these things, because some of them, I mean, all of them, none of them have ever been built before. And so, you know, when we met with initial code consultants and architects and engineers on some of the projects, they were, you know, shaking their head, just saying, you can't do this. And for me, whenever somebody says you can't do something, it's the perfect storm. I mean, it's the thing that makes me want to do it even more. I get my back up. I'm like, we're going to figure out a way to do this, because it's not that anything's possible, but, you know, human beings are pretty industrious and creative. And I wanted the IMA to be known for being a place that was willing to embrace challenges and also to make artists' dreams come true. It's, you know, I was joking about the recession with you earlier in terms of jobs, but if you think about artists as professionals, which they are, they have fewer and fewer opportunities to do work on a public scale, especially in a time like this where public monies are constricting so much. And so it seemed to me that one of the things that could be really exciting and that tied into my mission as the head of the contemporary program at the IMA was to really give artists a platform to play and to challenge themselves and to challenge the public and to question what is the role of art in relation to the 21st century. How does it play out? You know, what are the different possibilities for it? How do you define it? And, you know, a lot of people, I think, I think the stereotype is that a lot of people feel threatened with contemporary art. But I think the reality is that if you're someone who works in a museum and you see publics coming through and school groups coming through, the thing that people take to most automatically in general is the contemporary work, particularly the kids, because they don't have preconceived notions about what art is or what art is supposed to be. And so I wanted to create a park that really put that question at the forefront and also figured out a way to put art projects forward that would appeal to a truly diverse audience. And I don't mean that in a kind of superficial way, but I mean in terms of every kind of background, every kind of orientation, every kind of mindset, giving people a touchstone, something to react to, something to have a dialogue about. And kids were very much at the heart of the way I was thinking about it, because my training is contemporary art, particularly history, and the decade that I worked on the most is the 1960s. And during the 1960s, there were a lot of artists, and the 50s as well, who were celebrating the unconscious and thinking about ways that they could make art that would somehow convey the unconscious in an immediate, sort of uncensored fashion. And one of the places that they looked, of course, like the surrealists in the 30s, was to the art of children and also the mentally ill, because they found that people, kids in particular, would draw in a way that was completely free.
And, they don't edit themselves.
Yeah, and they also look that way. They see things that way. They experience the world that way. They don't, I mean, I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, and, you know, they just are immediately who they are and without any kind of concern for society or any kind of repercussions of opinions or taste making or anything like that. And that's an incredibly freeing state to be in. And it's been really fun watching the park under construction. We haven't closed it off. It's been open to the public the whole time. And so sort of the people who've always used it have continued to use it, and then we brought, you know, other people have sort of come by out of curiosity, and you see people of all different backgrounds, you know, Mexicans and African Americans and kids and mothers with strollers, and you know, it's and some people are fishing, and you know, some people are playing frisbee, and some people are jogging, and
which leads me to a question: what do we know about people? Do people come with a different mindset to come inside a museum as opposed to outside a museum?
I think so. I mean, it's really hard to generalize with
sure.
that, but I think it's safe to say anyone who's ever walked into a museum knows that there are particular rules. You know, you can't run. You're not supposed to touch the work. You really shouldn't be screaming at the top of your lungs. I mean, there's certain you know, appropriate behaviors. And again, those are really difficult for children. You know, even as a curator, when I bring my children through my own galleries, I have to be careful to make sure they don't, you know, bulldoze the artwork. and you know, I mean, it's very humbling to be a curator and bring your own kids into galleries and realize what everyone else is going through when it's not your time with your kids. But, you know, I think that one of the things that the park has to offer is the absolute opposite of that, that there are no walls. It's a free space. You know, the IMA is free to the public also, but this is also metaphorically free space where people can run, they can wander, they can eat, they can engage with the art by touching it. I mean, many of the projects in the park are meant to be interactive or are produced through, have been produced through some kind of a community practice. For example, Alfredo Jarre, a Chilean artist who's based in New York, has done a project called Park of the Laments. It's essentially, I think it's the most metaphoric and poetic project that we have in the park across the board.
You're listening to the Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public
Radio. Meditate. It's a place of silence, and the formal structure of the project requires you to enter it. You walk in through a pathway underground through a tunnel, and you see light literally at the end of the tunnel that beckons. And as you climb up the amphitheater into this square park within a park, you meet this expanse of green with hundreds of indigenous Indiana native plants that have been planted along the periphery. And the only thing that you can see are walls of plantings, Gabion limestone rocks that are indigenous to Indiana, and the sky. And it's incredibly beautiful and minimal and reductive in terms of shutting everything out but the basic constituents of the natural world. And then, you know, you can sit in there, stare into space. You could do Tai Chi. You can read a book. You know, you can have a picnic. But you literally are inside the artwork. You're walking through it. You're activating it. You're completing it. Another project, which I think will become iconic for the city of Indianapolis, is Los Carpinteros' Free Basket. That's located at the 38th Street parking loop and the entrance to the project, which is also our handicap accessible entrance with parking. And that's a project where two Cuban artists have essentially created a full-size international basketball court that has somehow transformed into this surrealist landscape where you not only see the literal court itself, but you see the three-dimensional sculpture that reflects the trajectory of the bouncing balls from each team. So there are these huge red arcs and these blue arcs that represent the opposing teams, and there are basketball hoops. You can actually get out there and shoot hoops there. It's not going to be a logical basketball game if you play. It will be much more surreal, but it's already been amazing to see people interacting with it. And, you know, I mentioned to you before we went on air that we just had the annual conference of American museum directors here in Indianapolis for the first time since the 1970s, and we were showing off the IMA and the park and the facilities, and They ended their tour of the Art and Nature Park with about 100 of them standing on the court itself and with their jaws hanging open and smiling. And I said, it's a kind of project that you can't see without having a smile on your face. It just automatically appears. So there's a lot of joy in the park, I think, as well as contemplation. Some of the other projects, in terms of their interaction, we have a pier produced by Kendall Buster, who lives in Richmond, Virginia, and it's called Stratum Pier, and it echoes the topographical survey map forms for each level of the pier as it juts out over the lake. And from that vista, you can see Teija Mäkipää, who's a Finnish artist. You can see her ship, Eden II, that has a guard shack on the edge of the lake that people can climb up onto and see video footage of what's supposedly going on inside the floating ship. And then Andrea Zittel has a floating island, and that's a project that she's created where we also worked with her to run a competition with Heron School of Art students. And the winning students, Jessica Dunn and Michael Runge, have the opportunity essentially to become the IMA island residents, and they're living on the island for 6 weeks this summer, and they're doing a relational art project in real time where they're going to be blogging about their daily life experiences living on the island. They're doing a hydroponic garden. They have a rowboat, and when they put a flag up on top of the island and people ring a bell over at the lake's edge, they'll row out and bring people on for a tour of their personal habitat. And they'll be talking to people about what it's like living on the park, living in the park and on the island. And then we also have two other projects. One is by Type A, which is a two-man collaborative from New York. And they came and worked with the IMA staff for several years doing a team-building project. A lot of corporations and schools and nonprofits know about team-building. They decided to think about team building as an aesthetic experience, and they worked with an interdisciplinary group of IMA staff ranging from custodial to security and night watchmen and retail and curatorial and conservation. And they worked with these folks for 2 years doing retreats and different team building activities and talking about sort of the philosophical underpinnings of the park itself, what it was meant to be, how it could be realized. And then eventually that group worked with the artists in order to come up with a kind of sculptural metaphor for that experience itself. And they created this project called Team Building a Line, in which there are two 30-foot wide metal rings that are suspended from three telephone poles, one on top of the other. And what happens is that every year during the summer solstice, as the sun moves around the earth moves around the sun, the shadows of the two rings, which are reflected as interconnected on the ground, come into alignment and become one whole ring. And so it becomes a kind the really the most site specific project we have in the park, because it's tied to the solar system and the galaxy. And it's some people have referred to it as Indianapolis's Stonehenge. And then I think I'm missing one other project, which is Jeppe Hein's Bench Around the Lake. Jeppe Hein is from Denmark, and he has created a series of benches that are part of a body of work that he's done called Social Benches that really engage people with a kind of play in relation to the artwork. And we actually have an exhibition of his work on view in our McCormick Forefront Galleries on the fourth floor of the museum right now, a project called Distance, which is this motion-activated kind of roller coaster that pushes a giant white ball into movement through tracks around the galleries as you walk through. That same kind of interactive quality and connection to a kinetic work is really important to Bench Around the Lake, because what he's done is he's essentially created these benches that seem as if they're rising above the ground and then falling down beneath the earth and coming up at a different part all the way around the lake. They're bright yellow benches. There's a kissing bench. There's one bench that appears broken with a giant glacial rock that has landed on it in the middle of it, which is actually from the site itself. And they're all different designs. And I guess what I'm getting at in relation to all the art projects is that there are things you can sit on, there are things you can walk on, there are things that you have a physical bodily relationship to in relation to your experience moving through the park. So it's not static. It's really the antithesis of a traditional 20th century park because it's constantly changing. It's activated by the different people who are moving in and out of the park. And, you know, one of the things I haven't said is that the site itself dictated the definition of it in many ways because it's a lot of people see it as this beautifully romantic location, but it's actually a spot that is the result of industrialization and human intervention because it was a quarry for the interstate highway system for 65 in the late 60s when it was being built. And so that beautiful 35-acre lake used to be a rock quarry, and then it filled in. And there's all sorts of industrial remains that have been found on the property. And the thing that's amazing, of course, is seeing the way that nature reclaims it and keeps taking it back. But that dialectic between sort of the human-made and human intervention and the natural environment is really at the crux of the philosophical underpinnings of the park itself. And it determines what was possible out there. It's also, because it's bounded by the White River and by the canal, it is a floodway and a flood zone. And so it's a place that's going to get wet and that is constantly going to be changing in terms of how it's reacting to the pressure of the river. And that river is a huge force out there a lot of people may not recognize in an obvious way, but it's determining a lot of things that are going on in the city.
Sharon Gamble with Lisa Fryman, director of 100 Acres, the Virginia Bee Fairbanks Art and Nature Park. The park, on the grounds of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, is the largest venue of its kind in the country. It opens to the public this weekend with lots of special programming. You can find out more at imamuseum.org. Again, that's imamuseum.org.
You might call him Papa. You might call him Daddy. You might call him Father. Let's see, what are some other nicknames for...
Like Big Daddy.
Big Daddy, that's right. Chances are very good that you have some sort of father figure in your life, and I think we might have some suggestions for things you can do to fet your father on today's edition of that calendar thing we call...
What'll we do with Dad?
With Dad.
I say...
What will we do with Dad?
Take him to go see Jersey Boys. It's running through July 3rd, and I got to see it last weekend.
You had a great
weekend.
Time.
Had an absolute great time. What a fun show. I mean, certainly if you love Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, you'll love the show. I mean, it feels more like a concert than a show in some ways. But what a great story, great production. Even if you're not a fan, you'll become a fan after seeing the show.
And you'll recognize a lot of the music,
even if
you can't pull anything to mind.
Yeah.
So
I'm not even going to try to like sing like
you're
Frankie
not
going to
sing
no,
Sherry,
no.
Sherry Baby
no.
for me.
Your turn, Sharon.
Sharon. Here's what you'll do for Dad. You won't sing to him. Actually, that was very good. I have something very manly to do with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
You ready? It's Indiana Limestone Heritage Month.
I'm of course
saying,
it is.
It's solid as a rock. What can I
nice.
Say? And there are all sorts of events going on, believe it or not, in Monroe and Lawrence County. This is actually a pretty brilliant sort of collaboration. And there are things including a walking tour through the IU campus that highlights limestone architecture and sculptures. And you can find out more by going to a computer and typing in Indiana Limestone Month, and you'll get, believe it or not, a list of a whole bunch of activities. And,
of course
you know, your dad probably gave you some lessons about science early on in your life, including geology.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking.
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
Interesting exhibit down at Heron, Heron Galleries. Hector Duarte is a Mexican-born, Chicago-based artist who is going to be presenting several of his very large-scale murals on canvas. He's also, along with the show, which just opens and runs through July 29th, he's also going to be working with a bunch of the kids that are there at the Heron Summer Camp, and they're going to be creating murals as well, which is a pretty cool project going down at the Heron School of Art.
Love that. Speaking of kids and youth, on June 23rd, that's a Wednesday evening, at 8 o'clock, you can hear a free concert in Highland Park in Kokomo. It's a band concert, and Purdue University Director of Bands Jay Gephardt will return to the podium for a Spotlight on Youth program showcasing high school student soloist competition winners and a youth percussion workshop group in a program of music from around the world. And again, that's going on at the Kokomo Highland Park, Wednesday at 8 o'clock. That's June 23rd. Take your dad. Take your kids.
Yeah. You know, there's a ton of free concerts or fairly inexpensive concerts going on downtown throughout the summer. Of course, there's always the ones, the lawn at White River State Park. Those are, you know, a little bit bigger concert, like Moody Blues and stuff is coming up. But then also you've got the lunchtime concert series at the City Market featuring a lot of sort of jazz and singer-songwriters and stuff. In fact, they're going to be celebrating Elvis Week next week. With concerts there during lunchtime.
I'm making peanut butter and bacon and banana sandwiches in honor of that.
Pickle too. And then Easley Winery, Rathskeller, they have concerts all summer long. The zoo, will be getting to that soon. But then also going on right now, at the Historical Society, the concerts on the canal are taking place every Thursday through the end of August, and those concerts are at 6 o'clock. And great. The next one coming up, Peace Train and the Flower Power Brass, favorite hits from late 60s. And the 70s.
Oh, that's
coming up on
like
the 24th.
Yeah. And while you're down there, you can take a ride in either one of the paddle boats or one of the help me gondolas.
There you go.
Hey, the Art Museum of Greater Lafayette is having an exhibit of the original cover art from a lot of the Saturday Evening Posts from the 1950s and early 1960s. The exhibit's up right now, and it runs through the second week of September, so check that out. Art Museum of Greater Lafayette. Cover art from Saturday Evening Post, sure to be a nostalgic hit, so if you have a grandpa somewhere in your universe, you might consider that for a road trip.
Something going on Saturday the 19th, so if you're listening to us Friday night, it's tomorrow evening. If you're listening to us Saturday afternoon, it starts from 5 and goes until 10, and it is up in Carmel, in the Carmel Arts and Design District. They are hosting their second annual summer wine tasting event. This is a great thing to take dad to, of course. There's going to be all local wineries, Best Vineyards, Buck Creek, Carousel, Grape Inspirations, Turtle Run, Mallow Run, Wizard Wall, that are all going to be doing tastings up there. There's also going to be live entertainment and art as well. Again, this is taking place Saturday evening in the Carmel Art and Design District.
What? Dads like to drink? I'm shocked.
And last thing I have is Symphony on the Prairie is opening up this weekend. Pictures at an exhibition on Saturday night. Next weekend, Marvin Hamlisch at the movies. And then, of course, on the July 4th weekend, Star Spangled Symphony up at Connor Prairie with the ISO. And we'll touch on more of that schedule throughout the summer.
Excellent. And I have one last thing to take dad to, especially if you've just tuned in and you haven't heard about the 100 Acres Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park. There is programming going on all this weekend to celebrate the grand opening. There's music, there's hands-on activities, there's food and beverage, and round up some dads and take them over to the IMA and celebrate this amazing new canvas for art of all kinds.
There you go. And we'll be back next week with more ideas of what you can do with your dad and your mom on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You may know jazz pianist Gary Walters for his work in Kathy Morris's band, though at one time or another over the past 20-some years, he's played with almost every notable Indiana jazz musician. During the last 5 years, he's been touring and recording with singer-songwriter Carrie Newcomer. But now the only person he is backing up is himself with a new solo CD of a few standards and lots of original piano pieces. Travis Unicola chatted with Gary about the new CD.
Gary, welcome to Art of Matter. Great to see you.
Oh, great seeing you too, Travis.
It's been too long.
Yeah.
Speaking of time, moments in time, we're actually right now listening to the first track off of your new CD. This is one of the pieces on the CD that's actually not original. This is Miles Davis tune.
Yeah, it's a classic old tune of Miles that I first started playing with the late, great Chuck Carter and the Carter Markowitz Quartet. And so it's a fun tune. And apparently Miles even... he heard it at a Texas two-step dance.
Really?
And when he was touring that part of the world, and said, "That's kind of a cute little thing," and twisted it into his own tune, Fran Dance.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the great tracks that's on the CD. We're going to talk about that in just a bit, and because I know each one that you selected has a very specific reason for being on the CD.
That is a little bit.
Yeah, but first I want to just sort of backtrack a little bit. You've played with a lot of bands, a lot of jazz bands. A lot of people know the work you've done with Kathy Morris, and then past 5 years or so you've been touring and recording with not a jazz musician at all.
That's right. Yeah, I've been on the... in and out of the city and all over the country with Carrie Newcomer. I've been playing piano for her in her last four CDs, and when we tour together, it's pretty much Carrie on her voice and guitar and me on piano. So
yeah.
It's intimate settings even then, but she's well known and loved in just all parts of the country. It's pretty impressive to go to the West Coast and have folks singing along to her material, and go to the East Coast and the same thing happens. And, so, yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And she's a great singer-songwriter. I'm trying to, like, you know, Carrie Newcomer, Kathy Morris, both great, great talents, very cool, interesting women. Trying to figure out how the piano player juggles those two.
Well, of course, I don't juggle them in the literal sense, or even the figurative sense of time, because it was sort of...
But very, very different gigs.
Very different gigs, yeah. And for me, it's always been about a variety of things musically. I love jazz, and it's what I teach at Butler part-time, and it's what I... enjoy listening to amongst other sounds, but you know, a chance to play in more than one genre has always been important to me. And, you know, through my career, I've played in R&B bands. I've played actually country western a few times, and you know, gospel stuff a little bit, the folk. The world for me was a little bit of returning to my days as a high school kid when I had buddies who played guitars and sang.
Mm-hmm.
This is when James Taylor and Carole King and all those folks were first coming out, and so I'd play along on the piano with them, so when Carrie invited me to be a part of her world, and of course she's doing all original material.
Mm-hmm.
I've always enjoyed doing all original material, so it was a great transition and opportunity for me to add that new sound to my list of things I do.
Yeah. Now you've obviously recorded many CDs with many people over the years, and as you just alluded to, many styles as well.
Yeah.
But am I correct? This is actually your first solo CD?
Yeah. This would be the first time that my name is on the front cover.
Yeah.
And it's of course it's a solo piano, but nonetheless it's rather. Right. For some people, maybe even to see it, but no, it is the first time I've actually stepped out and said, "Okay, this is Gary Walters. This is what Gary Walters is about," and that's a little bit of what the title came from. The moments in time is like, okay, here's all the kinds of things and people I've been with, and things that are important to me in my world at this point in my life, and. And it's a moment in time in terms of a performance reality. You know, if you ask me to play those same songs today, they're not going to quite come out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I've told a few people this is either my first or my last CD.
Well, how did this all come about? I mean, how did you make the decision, now's the time to do this?
Well, it was really challenging to make that decision. I've had family, friends, and fans for many, many years who said, hey, come here, do your own CD. You know,
yeah.
They'll hear me playing on a recording of Kathy's or a recording of Carrie's or a recording of other people that I've performed with, and, wow, you should do one of your own. And or I'm out playing a solo gig, you know, mm-hmm. or a trio gig, and the same thing will come up. And for many, many years, I just felt like I didn't have a compulsion to do it. I didn't have any sense of need for the world to hear what I was offering, other than what I do with other folks. And so.
And now you do.
And yeah, I think I do. Well,
yeah.
No, I do.
Yeah.
Now I decided, yeah, that it's time to go ahead and take that extra step. You know, there's a little special risk in mm-hmm. doing it as you are yourself, and as any artist knows, like, oh, this is me.
One thing I really like about the CD that within the liner notes, you have a very specific reason sort of listed for each track as far as why you selected it. Either that's, you know, a favorite of someone that you know, or that's, you know, reminiscent of someone you know, or for someone. In fact, let's take a listen to, if you don't mind, Laura, Laura, Laura.
Yes, sure.
Which is for your wife.
Yes.
I mean, this is a piece you composed, obviously.
It is. It is. This is actually is a piece that is to reveal the secret. It's actually literally a moment in time. It was me sitting down at the piano and thinking about my wife and our 18 plus years together, and the various images flashing through my mind, and then just putting my fingers on the keys and seeing what came out. So it's a complete improvisation. I do think it captures some elements of what my wife is all about, and I've had many other people who know her have said, oh yeah, that's Laura, Laura, Laura. So
now what does she say?
I think she says the same thing. You know, that's a good question. I can't say that I've actually asked her specifically, what about that?
Mm-hmm.
She's being a good supportive wife and telling me the whole thing's good anyway, so who knows where the truth there is.
Well, since it follows immediately after Laura, Laura, Laura on the CD, I want to talk about Rosie Rosebud.
Okay.
Because that's for your dog.
That is for my dog, and it has a sort of now a bittersweet sense to it, because unfortunately Rosie Rosebud passed away. She was diagnosed with a cancer, and not 2 months ago, Laura and I had the It's a difficult decision. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to make it a downer show. You know, she was a sweetie that we'd rescued from Humane Society. That she came to us as an older dog with other medical problems as well. But she just had this kind of a gloom, I would describe it as, when she ran. That was just so cute. So I wanted to somehow figure out how to create that image musically for myself and for those who knew and love Rosie Rosebud. And so that's what came out of that, Rosie Rosebud.
I mean, the whole CD in many ways is very sweet, and it's very enjoyable to listen to.
Thank you.
You pick a song. I've just picked three in a row there.
Well, yes, yeah, so difficult. Maybe we should hear Shelley Intermezzo. Another original of mine as well, but Shelley Intermezzo is a song that I was studying composition with Dr. Michael Shelley from Butler University, and I was working on a big piece for strings and percussion and piano. It was my final project with him, and I needed to not think about that music for a little bit. So I stepped away from that score and sat down at the piano and started playing around with some ideas and came up with something that was back in my jazz world, styles more. And the result is the piece that you now hear called Shelley Intermezzo. So I felt like I should dedicate a little bit there to Dr. Shelley just for helping me to find those notes in spite of it not being what I was supposed to be doing at the time.
The recording of the CD. You recorded down in Bloomington?
I did. I was at the same studio, Airtime Studio, owned by David Weber. David's recorded lots of the folks in the IU community, as well as Carrie Newcomer. I've been down there for all of her albums. Excuse me. And several other folks that I can't really think of the name off the top of my head here, but David's got a wonderful studio out in the woods, a place that he built himself, and he has a piano that I've always enjoyed playing on. And you know, for piano players, you got to find the instrument first, sort of, and then think about the room. Well, it's doubly good in this case, because not only is the piano great to play on and the way it sounds, the way it feels, the way it responds, but it's also a nice studio space, and you get the added bonus of looking out the windows at the birds and the trees and the beautiful woods that he's surrounded his studio with. So
sounds ideal. I've got a whole new image of how I'm going to listen to the CD.
Has a whole naturalness. But the other part of the recording process for me was I was trying to get back to the idea of not taking advantage of the 21st century digital capabilities. So, in each case, these are complete takes without edit. I can hear all the warts. Some other people may hear a few of them as well, but it's it's sort of old school, I guess you'd say. Yeah. It's also reminiscent of what happened in the early days of jazz recording. Everybody stood in the same room and did their thing, even though it's just me. But I didn't want to go in and chop it up and reassemble it and say, oh, listen how perfect I am.
So each one a complete take, but not necessarily, I'm guessing, one take for each song?
That's also true, thank
so
you.
So you did it, you probably did a couple and then picked out the one you liked the most.
In some cases, it turned out still to be the very first take I'd done, but yes, I would listen to, if I felt like that was a good take, I didn't need it to record it another time, I would. Other times I did record several versions before I finally sat and listened to the 3, 4, or 5 copies and went, all right, which one's got the fewest warts and all that business. And so, it was a case that I did multiple takes at times.
Yeah. Briefly, tell me about the CD release party coming up at the Jazz Kitchen.
I'm going to be at the Jazz Kitchen June 26th. That's a Saturday. It will be from 7 to 10 p.m. That's that early show that David Adali likes to do these days. And he's very gracious in allowing me to do that. The plan is for me to be not literally in the middle of the room, but it will be a performance in a round where folks will be on all sides of me. And I'm not going to do 3 hours of solo piano. I wouldn't subject anybody to that. But I have invited a few great folks from the community to come and do some duos with me, including Matt Pivik, who is our newest faculty member at Butler University, a very fine jazz saxophone player. Along with Richard Dole on trombone, who everybody knows and loves, and Rich has a gig at the Aristocratory Tuesday night from 6 to 9. And then Dean Franca from the Symphony, who's in the group Icarus Ensemble with me. He and I are going to do a couple duos. And then closing out, it'll be myself in a trio with Peter Hansen, who's also with the Symphony and a fine bass player that... we use in Icarus as well, and John Crabill, who teaches at Butler University and is also in Icarus. So we'll do a trio thing to close out the evening. So
excellent. Looking forward to it. I'm sure we'll hear some of the tracks for Moments in Time and some interpretations of them that night.
Yeah, the plan is to do a few of them solo, but probably a couple of them I'll treat in a duo fashion. One of them I'm going to do with the trio. So that's the plan anyway.
Excellent. Gary, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter, and congratulations on the CD.
Thank you, Travis, and thanks for having me. I love the show. Great to be able to do this with you.
Travis DiNicola with jazz pianist Gary Walters. His new solo CD is titled Moments in Time and is available at Indie CD and Vinyl and Vibes Music and online at cdbaby.com and iTunes. Copies will be for sale at a CD release party at 7 p.m. June 26th at the Jazz Kitchen in Broad Ripple. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I chat with artist Jody Walters about her new installation.
I'll find out what's going on at Garfield Park this summer.
And I'll get a preview of the Early Music Festival. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.